各位亲爱的读者朋友们，让我们热烈掌声欢迎金恩平教授、石景天教授，还有我们今天的主持人，中国时报人间副刊的主编杨泽先生。那接下来我们就把今天的时间交给杨泽。
各位现场朋友大家好，我是中国时报人间副刊杨泽，我很荣幸啊，今天坐在这里，然后来帮大家服务啊。今天这场对谈应该是这个2009国际书展的一场压轴好戏啊。那大家都知道，史教授是一个很会说故事的人，他的书，可能在座很多人都是他的书迷啊。然后金安平女士啊，史太太，她也是一个很重要的历史学家，然后在时报出版公司也已经这次因此出版是他的第二本书啊。那还有他有其他的著作，陆续都会翻译成中文啊。那今天的对谈的题目呢，又特别的精彩啊。他们两位呢，分别写了中国古典传统的源头孔子的传，然后另外一本史景天教授的书呢，张岱啊，尤其在座很多人清楚张岱啊，但张岱其实可能是在这个古典传统的中期最后面啊，他对就是晚明清初，然后其实对《红楼梦》有很大的影响。好，那我觉得这一场对谈最有意思的当然是我们的两个对谈者，一个是女士啊，一个是她的先生啊。他们两个要进行的这个游戏规则有一点点复杂啊，他们刚刚跟我们解释了一下，这个好像不是只是 open book， 这好像是他们两个人把各自的考题都藏起来了啊，所以他们不知道彼此要问对方什么问题啊。这好像很像李清照跟赵明诚他们在玩的一个游戏啊。那所以他们今天前面的40分钟呢，他们会不管我们，他们两个人就会对答。那我建议是说，在他们两个人用英文对谈，每个人各问对方一个问题之后呢，我们请翻译的这个廷瑞呢，再来做一个摘要，再来做一个整理啊。然后到时候假如需要补充的话，我也会那个尽量来帮忙啊。好，所以我觉得我就不要再多说了。我想我们现在只是就让这个对谈开始啊。Lady first, or Professor Spence?
Actually, we didn't even decide whether
you. 没有决定谁先。
Would you like to ask me?
那就不管嘛。
Yeah, okay, okay.So, is this on?
Yes.
Can people hear? Okay. Okay, like this is better. I apologize for asking the questions in English, but it will be much clearer for me, and it will be translated or summarized by my friends here. I want to say that this is not a fake quiz show. These questions are just ones I thought of from reading Anping's book, and she doesn't know what they are, and I don't know what she's going to ask me about my new book. So that is our procedure: question and answer, without knowing what the questions are going to be.
大家好，首先呢，我要跟各位抱歉，我今天不能够用中文来跟大家对谈。那我想我今天会用英文，然后再请我身边的这位译者帮我把它翻成中文，翻成大意让各位听。各位要知道，我们今天的对谈并没有预演过，我和金安平女士，我们并不知道对方要问对方什么问题，这些都是我们读对方作品的时候心中有的问题，所以大家会第一手看到他的对谈。
So my first question would be on her book on Confucius, which has just been translated into Chinese here, but this was the one that came out a little earlier in America and England. And my first question for Anping would be like this. At the end of chapter 6, which is called Teaching, on the chapter called Teaching, Anping writes about Kung Fu Zhe, about Confucius. She says, there are steps, but no regime, because his teaching complements his life. His teaching fulfills his life. It mirrors a life unfolding, and it is natural. That's my quotation from her book. My question then is, for Anping, is this: how can other thinkers in China or other societies, how can they attain such naturalness, even when they have to work so hard to be precise about it? How does one attain true naturalness as a philosopher and a writer?
我的第一个问题就是各位手上如果这本孔子的书的话，你可以翻开到第六章。我想要问关于金爱萍女士在第六章最后一段，也就是215页最后一段的问题。如果各位看到这一章，你会看到她写到孔子对自己人生的描述，其实就是对自己教学生涯的描写。这是一段循序渐进的过程，而且呢，它的发展并未完结。 孔子的教学与人生其实是完全互补的，这反映出一段不断在开展当中的人生，也显示出一段符合天道的人生。那我今天的问题是，作为一个思想家或者是哲学家，或者是作家，不管是中国的还是其他的社会中的思想家、哲学家、作家，要如何才能够真正取得孔子所谓的天道？
我现在要就是向大家说，我非常抱歉，我回答是用英文回答，因为我们两个人就是在一起，一般生活在一起的话，就是说，尤其是讨论问题的话，全部都是用英文。 So here's my English response, or response in English. I would say that actually with most of the Xianqing Zhuzi, with most of the philosophers from the Xianqing period, it's not that hard to attain a kind of naturalness of one's teachings and one's life, because this is how the Chinese early thinkers ground themselves, so that teachings and life are never separated from one another. If you separate one from the other, it makes one abstract, and then you're totally, in a way, sort of, first of all, it's hard to transmit such a teaching. I think that's the reason why amongst the Xianqing Zhuzi, the early philosophers, Gong Xuanlong and Hui Shi did not really take off, but Meng Zi, Xun Zi, Sizhui Zhuang Zi, all these philosophers, therefore, because they married the two, life and teachings. So I don't see that as a difficult problem for the early Chinese.
那我的回答，首先我们大家听到他道经，我们可以用中文来进行。那金女士提到，大多数的先秦诸子，他觉得呢，要取得天道，并不是很困难的。对于这些先秦诸子来说呢，为学跟为人呢，是密不可分的，是不可以分开的。所以这是他们取得天道的基础。比如说像公孙策，还有惠施，他们并 没有那么耀眼的学术成就，或者是思想上的成就，这是因为可能是因为他们的为学跟为人比较不是那么的密不可分。但是如果各位看孟子、荀子、庄子，他们则是非常好的例子，因为他们的为学跟为人是相连接、互相紧密的影响的，所以他们能够取得真正的天道。Thank
you. My second question would be this. It was particularly striking for me in Anping's book about Confucius when she talked about how the philosopher was away from home, or we might say on the road, for at least 13 or more years, from in the Western calendar from 497 till 484 BC. For 13 long years, Confucius was traveling, often in great danger, with very few friends, in often hostile countries within what we now call China, but many different states. So my question for Anping is this, was this period of travel, and we might say travel and suffering, was that time of travel and suffering really essential to the way that Confucius developed his thought?
我想请问一下，在读我妻子的这个作品时，我感到非常印象深刻，就是孔子在外周游列国的时间是非常长的，至少有13年之久，从西元前497年到484之间，他都是在外，离乡背井，然后周游列国。那我想请问一下，您觉得这13年的离乡背井、周游列国的艰辛，对于孔子的思想有什么样的影响
？Well, I think that it had huge effects, consequences on his teachings. First of all, I think again this might sound like a cliche, but usually it's through periods of it's because one has confronted a crisis, or when the world is in crisis, that's when one is had to think on his feet, and then be imaginative, inventive, and then to push yourself forward to resolve certain problems. And I think this is absolutely true with Confucius' life, that he had to leave the war. There was no choice. He was, his whole life, I think his life was in danger. And so after he confronted this problem, he put himself on the road only with just a few disciples, Zilu, Zigong, and Yan Hui, and maybe one or two more, maybe Zai Huo. But that itself is this sort of period of going, sort of not really knowing where you're going to end up. And that, first of all, allows him to spend, have a lot of time with these few disciples, and to think things through and think things aloud with these disciples. And I think even in the Western tradition, it is true, isn't it? In order to make a leap in one's thought, often you have to go to the mountains, go to some wilderness, and then come back, and you bring back with you some knowledge of things that are so foreign that helps you make that leap in life. And it's
我想这13年周游列国是非常重要，可以说是至关重要，对孔子有至关重要的影响。如果说我要讲的说法是很老套的，他常常都会听到，如果你要有真正的成长，取得智慧，必定要先经过一般的折磨，一般的苦难。但是事实上却是如此，孔子经历了这么多动荡不安的日子，经历了那么多的危机，才能够逼迫自己临危不变，想出新的方式、新的思想，然后解决问题。同时呢，在他周游列国的期间，他身边跟着他的弟子有子路、子贡，还有颜回。那有时候不同时期还有其他的弟子跟在身边。在周游列国的这段时期，让孔子有充分的时间和他的子弟来相处。那他们相处的过程，也让孔子得以去思考很多重要的问题，而悟出真理。这在西方也有一样的传统。在西方，很多哲人或者是作家，他们是必须要躲到深山里，躲到荒野当中去，一个人独自生活很久之后，才能够悟出一些平常人不会想见的道理。这是很相近的。
This question is a different.Different kind of question. But if you read Anping's study of Confucius, of Kung Fu Zhe, you'll notice that I think she uses a great deal of commentaries by later scholars. by the great tradition of Chinese scholarly inquiry. And so she not only reads the early texts, but she tries to read later commentaries about those texts. And so my question for her would be this, the actual question. Do we need Qing dynasty thinkers, especially from the sort of Qianlong Jiaqing period, but do we need the Qing dynasty thinkers and their understanding of Confucius in order to understand him better? In other words, is our learning helped enormously by the Qing dynasty commentators who often now are not studied at all?
问的问题与注解有关的，如果各位看过金安妮女士的这本书，你会发现她不只去研究孔子本身的所说的话，或是相关的文本，她也用了很多后人后世的学者所做的这些注解。那我想要请问一下您认为清朝，尤其是在乾隆嘉靖时期的学者，对于孔子所做的注解？ 还有解释，您觉得这些解释会帮助我们更深入、更加的去了解孔子的思想跟学说吗？
I'm so glad that Jonathan Shi Jingqian asked me this question, because I really want to say that I'm someone who absolutely believes in 清代孔子学, completely believes in it, because in my own graduate studies, I've done a lot of Sun Yinqie, and of course, Sun Dai, especially Archeng and Zhu Xi, they offer a lot of commentaries as well, and very important commentaries, but it's sort of, in a way, sort of being guided, those commentaries were guided by their own Yinqie, by their own ideology. But in Qing Dai, especially 18th and 19th century, it's a different way of considering scholarship. Scholarship is based on culture, so it's evidence. So from these evidence that's gathered by the Qing Dai scholars, one learned a great deal, not just about Kongzi, Renzi, Xunzi, and Zhuangzi, but also about the period of time, let's say what the Zhangguo Shidai was like, or Chunqiu Shidai, what was that like? So one could actually use the commentaries to construct the world as well. So it's not guided by ideology, it helps a historian. All these commentaries, and these commentaries, what's so great about the Qing Dai commentaries is that it's a collective commentary. So they allow you to see the different readings and let the readers decide what might be the best way to interpret something. And on top of that, it allows all these commentaries to allow you to construct the world. And that helped, all these commentaries helped me a great deal to construct Confucius, to imagine Confucius.
我很高兴石行谦教授问的这个问题，我觉得这是一个非常好的问题。我自己呢，非常欣赏像是朱熹等学者的注解，他们是从理学的角度来理解孔子。 但是清代，尤其是在18以及19世纪这个时期的学者，他们的治学方法是以考证为基础，所以呢，并不是意识形态来做学问，他们是以考证来做学问，所以他们所提供的这些注解，关于春秋战国时代的注解，给了我很大的帮助，让我能够很客观的去重新。
So my next question would also be about source materials for studying this period of China. I'm sure most people here know that in China itself, and also great scholars here in Academia Sinica and in Taiwan, these scholars and in mainland and China, and here rather, and also in Hong Kong or in Xiangang, and also in the United States and in Europe, all of them have been using archaeology or the digging of texts. and particularly exciting for scholars in the last 20 years or so, has been the discovery of bamboo slips, a whole group of texts from the period just before the Qin dynasty that have very careful discussions of sometimes of politics, economics, and law, and philosophy. My question for Anping is, does she feel that the bamboo slip discoveries, in other words, the discipline of archaeology, is now changing our knowledge of what we might call Confucian thinking? And if so, what are the implications of that?
我想要问一下关于文本还有文献的来源的问题哦。现在呢，在中研院、中国台湾、香港、美国、欧洲等地的学者，他们都采用很多都遵循一个考古学家的一个角度来做研究。他们去挖掘一些古老的文献。那近年来，有人在发掘了许多的竹简。这些竹简的历史很悠久，是来自于秦朝前的这个时代。 这些竹简上面记录了许多关于政治、经济、法律还有哲学相关的文献。我想要请问一下安婷女士，您认为这些竹简的发现对于我们后世这些人对于孔子思想的了解有什么样的影响？
I myself spent some time sort of studying some of these 竹简 and texts and. Of course, the most exciting two groups collections of Zhujian, one is De Bodian, and another one is Shanghai Boguan, is the Zhujian that they've collected. And they're exciting for me personally because most of these Zhujian deal with moral problems, political issues, and especially in the Shanghai Boguan collection, one finds six different separate texts. They're quite short, but Confucius actually appeared in these texts, in these six texts. And it's usually in a big block, in a conversation situation. And certainly that, I think, allow us to imagine Confucius in the Dango Shi Dai, because these texts are dated to 300 BC. But I think even more important than that, I would say that if you put the Guodian together with the Shanghai Boguan Zhujian, you also discovered this, that certainly during the Xianqing period, there was no clear distinction between Lujia Sisha and Daojia Sisha. There's a lot of mutual influence, and I think it's important to understand that aspect of Chinese intellectual history. It's not until the Han Dynasty that there's an imperial government that everything became standardized and codified that you have schools of thought. But in the earlier period, this is much more sort of, you know, it's much more amorphous, much more a kind of, I think the less the distinctions, the better for us to think about questions and ideas and so I think Zhujian certainly the excavated Zhujian certainly made that particular contribution to our understanding of early philosophy.
我自己花了很多时间去研究这些竹简，那到上海博物馆研究过他们所收集的竹简。这些竹简上面记录了许多道德上、政治上的议题，非常的有趣，也非常的重要。那在这些竹简当中，有一些文字是提到孔子以及一些对话，让你能够透过这些竹简挖掘出来的竹简，去想象西元前300年的战国时代应该是什么样的风貌。 那另外还有另外，我觉得很重要的一点呢，就是如果你去读这些竹简，会发现在先秦时代，儒家跟道家并没有那么确切、那么明显的分际，而是比较融会贯通的。一直到汉朝，才有不同的学派，才将儒家跟道家非常明显的分开。 那我觉得去回顾这些竹简，可以让我们去意识到，其实呢，这些学派是可以融会贯通的，这一点我觉得很重要。
Thank you. My last question, I think, so a formal question before we can reverse the procedure. This question actually springs out of Unping's answer to the last one, which is very satisfactory. But, we didn't plan it that way. But I would say that for at least well over 1,000 years, right from I guess the early Song through to the Xinhai Geming period, for all that time, in different ways, what we call philosophy and ideas linked to Confucius were tested in the examinations. And Confucius became more and more an examination subject to be graded and measured and calculated, and the basis for promotion even to universities or to government. My question for Unping would be, do you think that this earlier examination tradition helped our knowledge of Confucius, or in a way cheapened the legacy of Confucius by encouraging a more simplified answers and trying to guess what the examiners wanted? In other words, did it put Confucian thinking more under state control, and did it somehow keep students away from this inner naturalness that I asked my first question about?
I think that both happened. Okay.
那我最后一个问题，就是回应金安婷女士刚才的回答，所以这并不是事先我们预演过的问题啊。刚才我想要问一下啊，在从宋代的早期到辛亥革命之间这几千年的历史以来，孔子的思想都被国家拿来当做科举考试的内容，那您觉得这是好事还是坏事？因为大家都为了要晋升，为了要考取得功名来读孔子，这样子会不会让孔子的教学它的意义被贬低呢？还是您觉得这样子其实是会帮助学者更加去了解孔子呢？但是如果说为了准备考试而去死背孔子的一些思想，会不会让学生们只会变得去为了考试而考试，而只去猜题目、猜答案，而不是真的深入去了解孔子的思想？这样子会不会阻碍学生们取得所谓的天道呢？
I think that Keju and the whole examination system has both a positive and also negative effect on people, on certainly the young. On the one hand, I think it's absolutely true. Lots and lots of young men will try to guess, you know, how the examiners would perceive their answers and what they would perceive as the correct answers. And so that makes learning 学 itself sort of pointless. 学 is for one's own self-knowledge. And so that makes it quite pointless. But on the other hand, I think Keju has a positive effect in this way, because Keju, I think, because these young men, in order to get anywhere, they have to go through these the examinations. And so the examinations force them to develop certain habits of a scholar. Once you acquire the habits, I mean, this is why I think it's great that this is the last question that Shi Jingqian has for me. I think this is a problem that Zhang Dai confronted during his own lifetime. It is about that, isn't it? It's about because you have to take exams, so therefore you develop habits of a scholar. And then what are you going to do with that scholarship is completely up to you. You can become someone who could take the knowledge, take the teachings of Confucius to a different level, or you can bring it down to a lower level, to something that becomes rote and becomes sort of pointless. And so I think both possible.
我的回答是，科举制度这样做呢是有好有坏的。一方面，它逼迫学生必须去养成研读孔子治学的这种态度，所以这一点我觉得是好的，是正面的。但另外一方面，如果学子是为了考试而考试而强背这些孔子的思想，那 但是并不是真的去了解他的真意的话，那就的确贬低了孔子的这些学说。但是就正如石井谦教授所写的《张岱》这本书，张岱本身也遇到同样的问题，他也是为了准备科举考试来研读孔子的儒家思想，所以他养成了治学的态度。但是之后呢，当你养成这个治学态度之后，你要怎么去应用这方面的知识，则是取决于个人。如果呢，你能够善用你的治学态度、你的知识，把它发挥在更多的层次上，那是非常好的。但是如果你让学习治学沦为为了考试死背的话，那就会使得学习本身没有意义了。
I just like to thank the translator.
It's wonderful.
Thank you so much. And now I have to get in the hot seat.
Right.
Okay.
So I'm going to. My questions are much easier. Because for me, I guess you can tell. And I'm going to start with something easy. I hope that you will eventually come on.A bit more difficult for Shi Qian. So let's start with the sort of the theme of this panel, which is 变局中的儒家知识分子. Let's think about 变局 and 知识分子. So my first question is this, is what might be the biggest crisis that 张岱 had to confront? What was the biggest crisis? And,follow-up question, and the most difficult decision you had to make in this crisis.
Okay, 我想要问石教授啊，我的问题一开始会比较简单，后来会越来越难，我希望能够慢慢的难倒石教授。我想要呼应今天的主题，就是变局中的儒家知识分子。那我想请问一下石教授，您觉得张岱他遇到最困难的最大的一个危机是什么？然后之后我还要问第二个问题，就是说张岱做过最艰难的抉择又是什么？
Yeah, that is deceptively easy. Not really so easy at all, but it's a good question. It's in two parts. What was the biggest crisis of Zhang Dai's life? And then what was his most difficult decision? I think for the biggest crisis, we need to remember one particular date, or in fact two dates. One when Zhang Dai was born, and this is by Chen Hongshou, Zhang Dai's very close friend. It's probably not Zhang Dai in person, but it's a late Ming intellectual. And Zhang Dai was born in 1597. That's in the Wanli reign, near the end of the Ming dynasty, 1597. And in 1644, the Qing conquered the Ming. So the Ming were conquered just when Zhang Dai was in his mid-40s. This meant that I think this was the biggest crisis for Zhang Dai, because he had lived his whole life under the Ming dynasty. And one of the central facets of earlier Chinese history, as I'm sure all of you have studied often, is what is the nature of loyalty and the obligation that you owe to the government under which you live. And Zhang Dai was very aware of the fall of the Ming, because he was actually writing a history of the Ming when it collapsed. And most people looking at the history of the world in around 1644 would have said that the Ming dynasty was one of the strongest and the most powerful. China's population was the largest, the trade was the biggest, and so on. This was a tough, integrated, unified country. And Zhang Dai had to decide how he was to cope, how he was to handle the end of the dynasty. And so the most difficult decision he had to make, I think this really might seem startling to us, but I think it would be the right answer. The most difficult decision for Zhang Dai was, now that the Ming dynasty had collapsed, should he keep on living? In other words, how much was his life a part of the older political order? And Zhang Dai thought carefully about the alternatives. And one of the alternatives to ordinary life would be never again to serve the government in any way, or never to show the new government any loyalty, or, most personally agonizing, should you commit suicide or not? And it's perhaps not so well known that at the end of the Ming, many, many Chinese took their own lives. In fact, far more than any logic would lead you to believe possible. And they took their own lives, I believe, because they felt a sense of incredible loss when the Ming collapsed. And they saw it as questioning all their beliefs, and they didn't see how they could bring their children up in the new regime of the Qing. And they were also aware of the Manchus, the Manchurian, as coming in from the north and of being a different background than the Han Chinese. So Zhang Dai, some of his very closest friends, committed suicide, and Zhang Dai decided not to. And for many of us that might not be such a hard decision, but for him it was hard. Should you keep on living? And he said, yes, you should. And he analyzed in various letters to friends and in some of his writings why this was. And when his very, very closest friend took his own life, Zhang Dai actually wrote a passage saying he'd been thinking about this again and again and again. This man called Qi Biaojia, a great Ming scholar and administrator. When Qi took his own life, Zhang Dai was probably meant to write a homage letter. But instead he says, I think that was the wrong decision. Because the Ming was no longer functioning properly. The government was in disarray. If we had something to contribute to China, it could also be under the new regime, as new values are put in place. And so though he himself refused to take any sort of senior position under the Manchu government, he was tempted and gave in to one offer which he could not refuse. He was invited to help write the history of the Ming dynasty. So in other words, he was asked to help describe for all future generations what the Ming had been like. And for many Chinese scholars, this was a device of the Qing dynasty, the new dynasty, to get their loyalty by asking them, please help us write the history of the previous dynasty. And it was very hard for us, an intellectual Chinese with very good history training, to refuse that. So that was his most difficult decision, I think, not to commit suicide, to keep living, not to officially serve the government, but to help future generations understand the Ming dynasty.
问题听起来好像很简单，但是其实并不然啊，它其实是非常困难的一个问题。它有两个部分，第一个部分是说张岱所遇到最大的危机是什么？那第二部分是说张岱所做过最困难的抉择是什么？我想呢，最大的危机应该就是明朝的灭亡。张岱和一辈子大多数的时间都是处于明代的统治之下，那在明灭之后，张岱必须要选择是否要继续的活下去，还是应该要自杀？因为在当时有许多的中国人都选择自杀，他们不愿接受异族的统治。 另外呢，张岱所要做的困难的抉择就是说是否要效忠，效忠跟他的义务的这两个问题。明朝灭亡之后，清朝的政府他们曾经邀请张岱来为明朝驻使，那这对张岱来讲是一个很难推掉的一个邀请，因为他的确很希望能够为明朝驻使，所以这对他来讲是一个很大的挣扎。他有很多的好朋友都选择了结自己的性命，但是他一再在思考自己是否也应该走上一样的路呢？就是他最后决定不，他应该要活下来，然后不会再为清朝做比较高的职位，也不会为他们效忠，但是呢，他会为明朝驻使，为后世的子孙留下历史的见证。
My next question is actually it's a follow-up to what I just asked, because I want to pursue this just a bit further. Here, Zhang Dai, from what you suggest, it seems like you're saying that his decision to write the Shi Wei Shu, and then to write the Shi Wei Shu Houji, the main history, and then the continuance, the second part to the main history, is that this is out of a sense of duty. But could it be something else? Because it became a kind of obsession for him. Why was he not satisfied with just writing Xiaopi, with just writing remembrances or memoirs? What? He was such a master at doing that particular form of prose writing.Why not just that? Why the story?
我接下来的问题呢是继续的问与刚才陈先成长的问题继续问啊，就是张岱根据石景谦的说法，张岱做这个抉择决定要继续来写史，好像是为了要效忠国家。但是我想要问的是，除了要效忠国家之外，张岱会不会是因为对于驻史非常的着迷呢？为什么他会如此的对纪史作为一个史学家如此的着迷？他的小品写得那么的好，为什么还不满足？为什么一定要当一个史学家呢？
Yeah, this again difficult question in the sense that we have to look more carefully at Zhang Dai's life, I think, to answer this question. Perhaps the broadest one sentence answer would be that Zhang Dai.Like maybe many of you here, began to realize that he wanted to be a writer. And he made the decision that perhaps writing, as well as many kinds of pleasure that we might talk about later, but that writing was something that he was drawn to do. And Anping called that, asked me if that was an obsession. And I think in a way the answer would be yes.It's hard to translate the word obsession. But Zhang Dai grew up in a very wealthy family in the area in Shaoxing, in northern Zhejiang province. And they had houses in Westlake, in Xihu, in Hangzhou. They were wealthy in the late Ming. And he could have probably done most things that he chose, but he began writing short pieces, and he found that he loved reading history. And he felt that in reading history, certain problems arose about the past that he wanted to solve. And we know that as he began writing some of his earlier pieces, including poetry and essays of travel, he also got this idea of writing a history of the Ming.And he was working on a history of the Ming Dynasty by about the year 1625. And the books that Anping mentioned, the Shi Gui Shu and the Shi Gui Shu Houji, continuation of Shi Gui Shu, these were Zhang Dai's own private decisions to write the history of the Ming. And in writing about the Ming from the year 1620 onwards,This meant that a very strange thing happened inside Zhang Dai's brain. It would happen to us as well. He was in the middle of writing a history of the Ming, and then suddenly he had to find that he was writing a history of the fall of the Ming. And it reminds us how incredibly different these two things were. He was writing, first of all, you might say more or less a picture of a dynasty in great power and so on, and then suddenly he has to adapt to this and write about its failure. So he decided to keep on writing about the Ming, and that became truly an obsession. That's 3.5 million characters long, his draft of that book. 3.5 million characters. And he says that when he fled from the Manchus and spent many, many difficult years, he always carried this manuscript with him. It must have been in a big suitcase. But anyway, it's a very large manuscript. But at the same time that he was finishing this vision of his, which you might call an obsession, he also accepted money to do a more official version of the Ming. So there are, it gets us into the exact nature of history in the late Ming period and the very early Qing, as the scholars had to think through their own motivations. So it's an obsession to write about the Ming, but it's a career decision to get some money to also do that for the scholars in Hangzhou who invited him to come and join their staff. And so he saw these as very different things, writing a private history for private reasons or accepting somebody else's money in order to write for, essentially for them and for the new dynasty.
张岱他的确，你们所谓的obsession，他的确是很着迷、很坚持要写史。他出生非常的富裕，是在绍兴的有钱人家。他们家在西湖边有度假的别墅，他可以过得很好。但是张岱却发现自己非常的喜欢写作。那他一开始是写小品，但之后呢，他开始读历史。但他读史的过程中，
他意识到，这些有一些历史上的问题，他想要去解决，也因此呢，他开始想要自己去写史。那刚才金嘉宾女士提到说，张岱写了十卫书，还有十卫书的后记，这是张岱他自己决定要写的这个史历史啊，不是任何人或不是政府付钱请他来著述的，想要原本的打算是记述明朝的历史，但是写着写着突然有了这么大的变革，变成他要写的是明朝是如何去灭亡的，所以这对他来讲是一个很大的改变。所以呢，他也是延续他的这个志向，他继续的记史。他所写的手稿非常的长，也非常的多，长达350万字之多。那在他逃亡的时候，就是明朝灭亡之后，他为了躲避满清政府，他提着他的这些手稿躲到山林里头。所以我想那个手稿一定很重，一定是很大的一个行李箱，但是他还是至始至终都是拿着这个手稿，直到他写完十卫书还有十卫书后记之后呢，张岱也有接受别人的委托，就是有接受别人委托，有付他稿费稿酬的，去为杭州的一些学者来写史。那这对张岱来讲是不一样，就是有不同两种动机。前者是因为自己想要写史而写史，那后者只是比较像是生涯上的事业上的接受别人委托来写史。
From your writing of Zhang Dai and your writing of other books, it seems like that Jonathan, you agree with what Zhang Dai said about the gaps of history, that it's like a lunar eclipse that causes gaps in the moon, that despite the gaps, the spirit is still present. And if a person keep on seeking for that true spirit, then the moon will appear in whole form again. So it seems like you agree with that just from reading your own writing on Zhang Dai, and you're writing some other historical topics in history. If that is the case, then as a historian, how do you see the true spirit of the past despite or in spite of the gaps in the records? And one follow-up question, do you prefer to work with records that have gaps, many gaps?
时期的纪史史料是不够充分，可能有些地方是你找不到的。那我想要问一下，从我看石景谦教授的著述，包括张岱还有其他的书，我觉得在里面，各位如果读过张岱这本书，就会看到石景谦教授把史缺比喻成像是月亮的月全食或是月食一样，但是史教授是说呢，这个史缺并不会影响你对于历史的了解，读史还是一样的那么令人着迷，只要你够用心，你仍旧能够看到月亮的全貌。但如果您是这样想的话，我想问一下，你觉得你比较喜欢处理有史缺的史料呢，还是很完整没有史缺的史料？
This question is about the whole nature of history, really. Why do we write history? Why did Zhang Dai write history? Why have I been writing history? And again, perhaps many of you are writing or want to write history. Zhang Dai was very much aware of motivation in the past. He liked to see what made people do what kind of thing. And he did, as Andy mentioned, he sometimes produced images like this of the eclipse of the moon. And when talking about history and astronomy, Zhang Dai, in a sense, is talking about the power of knowledge. In other words, he says that the historian is like an astronomer. What he means by this is that when an eclipse of the moon comes to be visible, whatever time it is, on our planet Earth, when people see an eclipse of the moon, they are going to be terrified. They think the world is coming to an end. And the only people who can reassure them are those who know enough astronomy to say, no, it's okay. It's all right. The moon is going to come back and be whole again. But to convince people of this, they've got to be knowledgeable, they've got to be confident, and they've got to be sure that they are right, that they've got their ideas right, and that the moon will return. And I won't go into other examples, but Zhang Dai, he was very conscious of that problem. So one level of answer would be, he's talking about the power of knowledge. But a more difficult side of this is the power of imagination, which I know Anping means as well. So knowledge is power, but imagination can be power. And Zhang Dai reflected about the fact that many great Chinese historians long before he lived, who he admired very much, would in fact try to fill the gaps. And there's a famous quotation from Confucius about that. Should one fill in the gaps when they've been left out? This for the historian or the writer of history is again very, very difficult. I'm sure there are bestsellers each year in Taiwan in which people make up most of the history. And sometimes these will simply be called a historical novel. At other times we'll have what we think of as most of the story, but there is a small piece missing. Now at that stage, the historian has to either ignore that as a problem or maybe just mention quickly that it's a problem, or the historian has to try and think and think and think and use their imagination to see what is the most likely answer for that. How can you explain it? And that line is always a very thin one. Zhang Dai really loved the work of Sima Qian and the Shuji. He loved it. And to read him all the time, constantly, he's echoing Sima Qian again and again and again. And the only other person he echoes so much is Tao Yuan Ming. Tao Yuan Ming to him was the best kind of scholar of imagination and poet. Sima Qian was the best possible kind of historian, because he had enormous knowledge, incredible knowledge of China's past. But when there were gaps, he tried to confront them skillfully. He tried to show how other texts helped him answer those questions. But sometimes, there's no doubt, he just made things up. And sometimes he made up a conversation when in fact all we have is a summary of the conversation. Other times he would make up a dialogue between political figures when we know he could not have known. So for the historian, how to fill in the gaps, whether we do it privately or whether we do it if ordered by our government is a very, very big, important decision. But if it's a private decision, we try and use logic and we try and use accuracy, and we try and use something that was truly possible in terms of the time, and to fill those gaps in. I guess I'm ambiguous about this in the sense that I like the gaps. History without gaps, in a way, would be history that's got no filtering at all, either by the past or by the historian. And then every action ever committed in the past needs an infinity of time and words to explain it to the full. And probably that task is best left to the great novelists in different societies. But the historian does have to confront it. And maybe I'm too confident about this, I sometimes feel that if you're a historian and are working very, very hard at something, you may have a sense of how to fill the gap. I still don't believe you should do it without any acknowledgement, but you can maybe use your knowledge to be able to guess at some of the problems that people see in interpreting the past.
在书中所做的比喻讲到史缺就跟月食是很类似的，那我觉得历史学家就很像天文学家所扮演的角色。当月食出现的时候，人们会非常的惊恐，以为世界末日已经到了。这时候天文学家因为有足够的知识、足够的自信，就能够告诉人们不用恐慌，没有问题。那史学家也是一样的，当历史出现史缺的时候，就像是月食。那作为一个好的史学家，他要有足够的知识、足够的自信来补足这个不齐。那我个人觉得，这就要依赖知识的力量。那有些时候呢，也会依赖想象力的力量。张岱非常的敬仰司马迁，然后他非常喜欢司马迁所著述的《史记》，同时他也非常的欣赏陶渊明。那《史记》当中，我们知道的确有一些部分是由司马迁自己所编出来的对话，这是历史学家去做想象的部分。那我个人是很喜欢，我个人觉得有史缺的历史是非常值得令人玩味的。但是我想处理这种问题的时候，要用很多的研究，再用你的判断力来奠基于你的知识，足够的知识才能够来补足这个史缺的不足。
Conversation, I might just add to add another question about this, whether you feel that even when all the, when the records are fairly complete without many gaps, whether still there are things that are gaps, for instance, the intention of the characters of the past, whether those are the gaps that are hardest to fill in.
Yes, that is true. There will always be gaps. And there will always be other kinds of gaps in history which come when a historian, professional historian or an amateur historian who is looking at a record of the past realizes that the record that's passed down as accurate is in fact false. In other words, the historian realizes that there are gaps even though they've already been filled in by somebody else. And this can be very often when history is ideologically written and something that really we now can see are simply lies. They were untruth remarks. We can see that these in fact should be removed and we should create a gap. In other words, we should create a gap instead of accepting what looks like knowledge. And that is one of the tasks that historians do. It's one of the things that usefully they are protected so that they can do it in university or school settings. That can be a very important part of government, I think, and good government as such. But the creating of gaps where they are necessary is a piece of kind of destructive work that the historian does in order to make a better record for the future. But history is never left without the possibility of being questioned and having questions asked about itself. And we should always be modifying our view of the past, I think. You can just think about American society today or European society or Chinese society. We need to rethink constantly what the most flagrant alterations of the past have been.
没错，很多的史料几乎都会有史缺，但我想要讲的是，史缺未必是坏事。有时候史缺被补起来了，但是其实这补起来的东西并不是事实，所以我们要很小心这样的谬误。尤其是在国家或是社会被意识形态左右的时候，他们很可能用其他的方式来弥补史缺，而进而扭曲了历史。所以这是要很小心的去判断的。历史的确应该永远都要存在所谓的史缺，永远都有空间让我们去做诠释、去考证以及去想象。
This is my final question, and we would love to hear your questions, and we'll do our best to answer your questions. So, my final question is for 石子谦先生. How would you compare writing a book about a scholar and an aesthete with writing a book about an emperor like Kangxi or Yun Zheng? And then a second question, and what about the difference between writing about a subtle man like Zhang Dai and writing about an illiterate like Wen Yuan? What do you wish the reader to grasp, to get from either kind of books?
这是我的最后一个问题。之后呢，我想要跟我希望可以跟读者有互动，所以欢迎之后你们可以提问。那我想请问一下石子谦哦，在写关于一个学者的历史与写一个在位者，比如说是康熙皇帝、雍正皇帝这样的历史，两者有什么不同？那我的第二个问题是，我们都知道石子谦教授写过一本书叫做《王室之死》，那王室是一个不识字的市井小民。那另外一方面，石子谦又写了张岱这样子一个文人，这两者有什么样的差异？那你又希望读者从中看到什么东西呢？
Yeah, this is a nice question to end with, because I have it's been a rather long time, but I guess over 46 years or something of writing history, I have tried to look at both the scholar aesthetes and the emperors and the illiterates. And of course they all have utterly different kinds of problems about the sources. To take those three categories just very briefly, we could again have questions if you wish. The scholar aesthete, in a way, is the most fun to write about at the first level. It's probably in a way the easiest, because the scholar and aesthete has written so well about himself or herself, as we find now more about Chinese women in history. We find a deeper record than we suspected. But these are the words of articulate, highly articulate people, often very sensitive. They might not always tell the truth, but they'll say and write beautifully. And so the challenge is to translate them as well as you can, and to make them available to other people. And so that is Zhang Dai right there. You can see some of the problems, though, from that cover, that Zhang Dai has clearly had many too many parties in the last few weeks, and he's also sort of falling asleep on his book. If you look carefully at the jacket, you'll see that Zhang Dai is representing here after probably a night of drinking, having given up really reading. So that these aesthetes can tease you, they can joke about the past, but they are fascinating, and you can usually create, if you're careful and work hard, you can let the Chinese words speak entirely for themselves. And I tried to make Zhang Dai as much as possible from his own writings, because he wrote wonderfully. Even I could tell that as a foreigner. But particularly his book called Tao An Men Yi is completely beautiful. It's absolutely amazing writing. It's difficult, because he was a high aesthete, and I'm just a simple student compared with that. But Zhang Dai used the whole knowledge of China's past and the complexity of Chinese language to write beautiful books, and so did many other people I've studied over the past. With emperors, you're in difficult ground, just as you would be with modern political figures, but with emperors you get hundreds of thousands of words in state documents, but you're very often not sure who wrote them, whether it was the emperors themselves, usually probably it was not. So you have the question there of dealing with speech writers, and how do you evaluate people who are writing for the man in power. And people lied a lot about political events. One reason I spent quite a lot of my life looking at the Emperor Kangxi. Kangxi and to some extent Yongzheng, was that those two extraordinarily powerful and often quite cruel and devious emperors, but very talented men. They happened to write an amazing amount of their court documents themselves. And we know that because the documents have been preserved. And we can actually see their handwriting, and we can do handwriting checks. The reason for this is that those two emperors, Kangxi started ruling in 1661. Yongzheng died in 1735. So for that 70-80 year period, we have a very good record of the emperors thinking aloud, under pressure, writing their thoughts in their own handwriting, in red ink, so you can actually see the red stand out in the archives. And there's a major collection of these archives are in the Gugong Museum here in Taipei, and others are in the mainland or in other private collections. But the emperors are accessible, but some emperors are more accessible than others. And I chose deliberately the two who seem to be the subtlest and have the most to say that we know they really were saying themselves, and trying to create a picture of the emperor that would also be human. I tried to imagine what it would be like to be an emperor, since I was not one. I thought how strange it must be to be so powerful and yet have so many complex decisions to make. And in Kangxi's case, by the fact that he had such a large family, 54 children. And with 54 children, you've really got to look carefully at the future of the society. With Yung Jung having a particular sort of analytical mind, but also a very suspicious mind. And I know that Yung Jung and Kang Xi have made wonderful, there have been wonderful television series about both of them, of which I've seen quite a lot. But those are well done, because they're often based on some of the real doctrine. The last part of Anping's query would be dealing with the illiterate people, those who never had a chance to write down their thoughts. And this has probably interested me the most, because there the historian is doing something else besides copying or analyzing documents from the past. The historian is trying to work out from somebody who never had a chance to read or write, whether they were male or female, old or young. You can just pick up a moment in their lives and try and recreate the rest of the life. And I in my some of my writings, like other historians now, have been drawn more to legal history, law history, because texts of criminal cases very often keep dialogue between people who were illiterate, but other people overheard the dialogue, and this got into the court record. We can reconstruct this, the moment in which something happened, by looking at all sorts of, you might think of them as unlikely reports. So it's actually one of my own favorite books of mine. It was The Death of Woman Wang. Woman Wang never had a chance to read or write. She had no choice about her marriage. She was killed by her husband after trying to leave him. All of this in the early Kangxi period. But, and yet by looking at Woman Wang through the village she lived in, which could be traced to the area of Shandong province near Tansheng-xian, one could find the Tansheng-xian documents, one could find the local history of Tansheng, one could find an official who was working in Tansheng in the year that Wang, that Woman Wang died or was killed by her husband. We could find, we know what the weather was like, we know what taxes were like, we know that Shandong had just had an earthquake as bad as the recent ones in China near Chengdu in Sichuan. We know that Woman Wang, in other words, lived through the earthquake. We can tell what the marriage customs were. We can tell what the chances were of her being killed if she ran away from her husband. We can tell how the autopsy was conducted. We actually have details of how her body was examined from what we call forensic texts from the Qing. We even know that when the magistrate wanted to inspect the body of the murdered woman in 17th century China, he was not able to look at the body of the dead woman because of propriety. He had to ask old women from the village what the body looked like. And by such details, we slowly begin to picture the year of 1670 in China, in which this unknown woman, we don't know her name at all, nor her given name. We just know her family name was Wang. And so she's just Wang Shi-Zhi, woman, I translated it, Woman Wang. That's the only name she's ever going to get. And yet you can write about her, I feel, in a way that in different countries and different audiences, people have been moved by her story. And to me, that's one of the most satisfying kinds of history.
我也写世青小明，我也写像张岱这样子的学者。那我想说的最我觉得最容易下手也是最很有趣的就是写学者，因为通常学者他们的表达都非常的清楚，他们自己的写作非常的优美，风格非常的迷人，所以我非常的享受去研读他们的著述跟史料这个过程。那我所面对最大的挑战就是如何把他们这些优美的著述翻译成英文，然后让讲英文的这些人也能够看到这些优美的著述。 那我也写在位者，特别是我写了很多关于康熙以及雍正皇帝方面的历史。在写在位者的历史的时候，有一个比较困难的一点，就是你不知道宫廷中的史料是由谁来著述的。康熙跟雍正皇帝比较特别的一点，他们亲自留下了很多自己亲笔所写的史料，是到现在都还可以考证，在故宫博物院就有一些他们的手稿，所以我研究了他们的手稿，他们用红色的墨水亲自写了很多的稿手稿。那我们会去判别这个字体是谁写的，是不是真的是雍正或者是康熙皇帝他们亲自写的。接下来我想要讲的是，我在写这些皇帝的时候，我的很重要的重点是希望能够给他们比较人性化的那一面。所以我自己本身不是一个君王，但是我透过想象力来了解，拥有这么多的权力，但是要处理这么多的事情，这么多的责任的时候，是什么样的感受，然后来重现他们的思考。像康熙本身有54名的子女，所以他必须要非常的谨慎，来为国家为自己的为国家的未来做打算。而雍正，我自己是觉得他好像是一个比较多疑的一个君主哦。那我知道有很多关于雍正皇帝、康熙皇帝的电视剧都拍得很好，那大家也都很喜欢看，我自己也觉得很好看。不过这些电视剧多半不是以史实为主的，比较多是一些比较虚构、比较有趣的情节。那最后我也写市井小民，不识字的市井小民，我自己觉得是最有趣的一部分。我《王室之死》是我最喜欢的一本书。王室是一个从来没有机会接受教育的女性，她不会读也不会写，她没有权利决定自己的婚姻应该是什么样子。那我要如何去重新建构王室所处的这个时代呢？透过许多的史料，我们没有办法直接看到，因为不会写，所以没有办法看到王室自己写的东西。但是我很喜欢去研究古代的犯罪记录，犯罪记录这些资料是收在宫廷里的。那罪犯他们被拷问或是侦讯的时候，他们所讲的话是会被记录下来的，所以这也是我的来源资料来源之一。王室之死是描述在康熙时代的一名不识字的平民的妇女，她与人私奔之后又被抛弃，然后回到夫家，然后被自己的丈夫所亲手杀死的这个故事。那我们去考证了当地的资料，就是王室所处的那个地区的资料，那时候可以得知当时的气候的情况，得知那时候的税赋的制度，那也知道王室经历了一场很大的地震。那在地震之后呢，他又是如何被谋杀。那从这些的考证都让我们可以去一窥当时时代的背景跟婚姻制度的面貌。像我们也做了研究，知道王室在被杀之后是由法医执行的解剖。那在那个社会，男性是不能够直接去窥视一名女性的身体，因为在那个时代他们认为这个女性的身体是丈夫所拥有的，所以法医还得请女性的长者来看这个王室的身体的尸体，然后再告诉像法医描述那个尸体看起来是什么样的状况。所以这些考证都可以让我们去了解那个时代的背景。而做这样的研究对我来讲呢，让我们能够让一个不识字的市井小民，他的一生，他的时代背景，转为英文，然后让世界各国的读者引起他们很大的共鸣，对我来讲是非常有成就感，也是很感动的一件事情。
谢谢金慧帮我们做了很准确的翻译啊。在开放现场朋友提问之前，就有一小小的补充，就是刚刚在翻译过程里面，其实讲到这个月食。大家可以找到这个《前朝梦忆》啊，《张岱传》的第六章的最前面啊，154页啊，这里面会有更多的讨论这个月食的啊，其实是相当复杂问题。那张岱好像 给了我们一个很有意思的一个比喻啊，就是我们在台上的史教授跟他的夫人，他们两位是史学教授、史学家、说故事的人，他们事实上也是天文学家。然后刚刚其实施景天也提到小说家啊，那我就不多说了，我想我们就赶快请大家来听。
我想请问史教授一个问题，是这样子，就是在中国五四运动之后，有所谓的打倒孔家店这样子的一种行动，因为他们认为说，就是孔子的那个儒家文化，从汉武帝的独尊儒术，一直到明清的八股取士，他们垄断了整个中国的学术思想。但是在台湾又有另外一种声音，像台湾的学者许卓云先生，他就认为孔子儒家文化其实是中国诸子百家的一种文，就是一种学术思想的开端。不晓得史教授以一个西方学者的角度，您是怎么样来看待中国的儒家文化？谢谢。
This question is for Dr. Spence. Since the May 4th event in China, the Communist Party, they defy Confucius thinking. They think that it sort of was the monopoly of the school of thoughts and thinking in the past of China. But in Taiwan, scholars have different thinking. For example, Shi Zhuyun, he thinks that Confucius' thinking is the start, is the beginning of all the schools of thoughts of thinking of all. So I want to know that from your viewpoint as a Western scholar, how do you view Confucius' thinking?
Maybe I could give a short answer and an unthinking answer too. Yes, I think the, in fact, the attack on Confucius thinking comes before the Communist Party was founded, and so that Confucius did become a kind of a scapegoat for feelings, negative feelings about society. I think you mentioned Bagu one. Did you mention the Bagu system or not? Okay. So, anyway, it was in looking at ways to sort of repair the damage to China that had taken place in the late Qing, a whole group of Chinese thinkers began to question the meaning of this inheritance that the Chinese had got. And they also, of course, questioned the nature of the examination, particularly the Bagu, the eight-legged essay, which made it even harder. So we got all kinds of Chinese intellectuals, some at one extreme, discussing making Confucius thinking a religion, the religion of China, which was quite an active group of scholars after about 1900 in China. So at one level you thought of having Confucius as the Chinese religion with all the ceremonies and teaching the young and giving honor to the elderly and so on. And so people as different as Sun Zhongshan or Lu Xun or others attack this tradition. And then with the May 4th period or Wu Si Yun Lun period, you got again other scholars who later supported Taiwan strongly, like Hu Shu and many others, who felt that China had to cut itself free from the past, and they saw Confucianism, like a Jui, or Confucius or Jui, as highly negative. So in thinking about modern Chinese history, we have to acknowledge the range of attacks on Confucius, and sometimes their subtlety, like there's a Lu Xun story, there's a Kung Yi Ji, a story by Lu Xun attacking the whole value system. But it's funny about how history goes in cycles, but because there was such a strong attack on Confucius, and then the communists were so very hostile for so many years, we lost track of a group of Chinese intellectuals who remained very sympathetic to the Confucian belief system. So, in fact, even in the May 4th period, we began to have all kinds of excellent scholarship, including archaeological scholarship and research. So the record has been very mixed. I think that because on the mainland, advisors to Jiang Jieshi and people in the Ministry of Education on the mainland did try to reconstruct a kind of Confucian belief system to help support the Kuomintang, or part of the Kuomintang. There was a complicated return, you know, of education about Confucius. And then when the Civil War divided China, again, by the logic of politics, many of those who most believed in Confucius did come to Taiwan, or maybe went to the United States or to Europe. So the philosophical belief got fragmented by the political belief, and it's been very hard to get back to a kind of equilibrium, you know. And now, Andy knows this much more than me, but in the mainland and in here, you get a very, very, very intelligent younger generation who are once again interested in these texts and their message, even if they're not being told to do so. That was one of my questions about the examinations and Confucianism. So, as a doctrine, it's had enormous changes in life, whether these are fashion or something deeper about ideology, we're not sure, but certainly it's, the tradition has come back and is being restudied, and scholars are finding new things to look at.
I think that in the 20th century, certainly there's a very strong reaction against Confucian teachings. And I think that strong reaction very often actually came from public intellectuals, or from dramatists, from novelists. So it's much more a kind of, I wouldn't call it public performance, but certainly it is for public consumption. And there's a good reason for that. And I think it's good. It's a way to force all Chinese to reflect on this tradition that had become such a huge weight upon them. But I would say this, that privately, that the effects of Wen Yuan Mengzi and Shen Zhen Xu Xun's effects of these texts had on the Chinese mind, privately, still was going on, even since the May 4th. And one can find that, lots of evidence of that in the diary writing, in the letter writings. It pursued private reflection when you realize just how deep that tradition has sunk into the Chinese mind.
则有不一样的看法，他们对孔子的思想是抱持较为批评的态度。那五四运动的时候，胡适也是如此，他那时候会希望新的中国可以与旧的中国做一个切割，所以会对于儒家有一些批判。那我觉得这个问题可能要看你看的这个历史的朝代或者是时段时期的不同，时期不同会影响很多。那但是我想要提出的一点是，就是有循环的，有循回的。大概在过去曾经听很多人在批评，但是看起来似乎现在又到了一个新的循环，人们又开始去拥抱孔子跟儒家的思想。在中国大陆，在过去蒋介石呢，他是试图以儒家思想来治国，然后来作为国民党背后的中心思想。那在国共内战的时候，这些思想就受到了一些比较政治化、比较政治化的影响，就不能够那么全然把哲学跟政治分得那么清楚。而接下来金央平女士会为我们补充。金央平女士指出呢，其实在中国有许多新的学者对于儒家思想是非常有兴趣的，而不知道这是潮流还是意识形态，但是其实儒家的这个传统是深植于每一个中国人的心中的。那即使说在二十世纪的时候有非常激烈的批孔的活动或者是这样的做法，但是我认为这是在外在在公众的一种表现，但是私底下在自己的平日生活中，许多中国的学者仍旧深受儒家思想的影响，深受《论语》《孟子》《荀子》的思想。所以即使是在五四运动之后，我认为还是有许多中国学者深受儒家思想。如果你去研究那一时期的学者他们自己的日记的写作，就会可以看到，就可以证明这一点。所以我认为儒家思想是中国非常重要并不可分的一个传统。
抱歉，因为时间的关系，我们只能再接一个问题。好多朋友，
哪边？我们要从那一边。
他在他的这个周游列国的时候，
他也碰到了很多隐士，这个隐士当然是给了他很多引诱，就是那他可以参加这些，就是跟像也变成一个隐士，也就是说完全对这个整个这个世界，好像说这个很俗气的这个世界，把它完全放弃掉。他并没有那样做，而且我自己就是我的想法，就是说不定完全是从我自己的想象里面出来的。可是我认为，就是孔子在这一点是，就是他完全知道他做的一切的事情都是失败的，虽然是失败的，就是在心里知道，就是某些就一切的事情，他当然在教学方面就很难讲了，可是那是看到他的徒弟，就是，可是在很多方面，就是在政治方面，他要使得这些影响都没有，最后没有，就说没有成现，可是他有了这一点，他认识到了这一点，可是还是继续做下去。我觉得这一点的话，我觉得是让我是非常敬佩。就是第二，就是第二个问题，讲宰我的问题。宰我的话，有一些尤其是这个清代的这个史学家，还有搞考证学的这些学者，他们也就说在考虑这个问题。后来宰我是怎么样？我很高兴你可以欣赏宰我，我也可以欣赏宰我，因为宰我在他说不定最后去了这个齐国，可是就是在《左传》里面讲的有一位宰成女，很多人在猜疑那个是宰我，可是就说不能完全就是这非常可靠的资料我们还是没有。
抱歉，因为时间的关系，我们的这个对谈只能到这里结束啊。那大家也许是私底下再到前面来再问他们问题。那我们再一次谢谢石景天教授、丁安平教授，谢谢大家到这里来，谢谢我们的译者，谢谢大家。
我们也谢谢今天主持人杨泽先生哈，因为等一下场地要归还给主办单位，所以呢，我们等一下在。两位稍后休息之后会移动到时报出版 C901 的摊位 ，C901 的摊位靠近 C 出口101大楼那个方向，在那边我们举办签书会的时候，各位读者如果还有详细的问题，可以当面跟两位教授就教。非常感谢各位的参与，在您离场的时候，如果身边有比较年纪大一点的长者，请注意他们的脚步。非常感谢各位，我们等一下 C901 摊位见，谢谢大家。
Hi, Roger.